here, and it's a great honor to see my friend Matthew Sweeney, whom I meet regularly at literary festivals around Europe, here tonight. Some years ago, I was invited by an Australian government department to go to China and write a poem about the Chinese landscape. They chose me because I'm known to be influenced by Chinese poetry. I had to travel around the countryside in a chauffeur-driven van with an interpreter. This interpreter looked to be 12 years old when she got into the van, and which was disconcerting. But she turned out to be 28 and very brilliant. She saved me many an unfortunate experience. When we had arrived in small towns, she said, I would say to her, "Shuja, what is this dish?" And she'd say, "Maybe chicken." And I'd say, "Maybe dog?" And she'd say, "Maybe dog." So I would say, "Maybe you could get me an omelette." But when we got back to Beijing, I said to her, "I'd like to take her for a meal." And she said she'd like Italian food. She'd been in Italy and she liked living in Italy. She said that she'd like an Italian meal, so I asked her over the meal if she would ever marry, and she said, "No, I will never marry except to a gypsy pickpocket in Rome so that I can live a wild, free life." I said to her, "What did your mother say?" And she said, "My mother said, 'You stupid girl.'" But this has got nothing to do with the poem. It's just the background to the experience of travelling around in southern China and coming to a particular place where there are thousands of acres of strange-shaped mountains, those classical landscape paintings of the Chinese with the mountains like pagodas. Do you know those sorts of pictures? They're not artistic license. The mountains are actually very sharp pyramids or very rolling shapes. They're the limestone core of the mountains that were under the sea. Some of them are like pagodas, some of them are like things that I describe in this poem. It's called "Among the Mountains of Guangxi Province in Southern China." I had been waiting for a long while in the sands of the world and was buffeted by its fiery winds. Then I found myself carried on a bamboo raft. I'm speaking literally now, pulled by a boatman down the Li River. A guest in Beijing at the Academy of Arts, brought to the countryside, I'd wandered out alone, a sheen on the night and across the ranks of water and close mountains that joined smoky earth and sky. When I saw the landscape around Weilin City and realised it was the same as the painter Shi Zhao had known it in the Tang period, I felt suddenly exalted, as though I were riding in the saddle of a cloud. The mountains' outlines were crowded one behind another and seemed a wild loosening of the brush, a switchback scrubbing, rounded or angular, until the last fibres of the ink had been used up again and again. Those narrow blue mountains make endless configurations. They are by far the main crop the province bears. Fang Tzu said that a twisted tree is not useful, and so it can survive for 1,000 years. A lead star plunged behind the mountain, as if the galaxy were crumbling more quickly than then. How to convey the strangeness of this region? I thought of migrating whales that break together almost upright out of the sea. That suggests their power, but not their stillness. Some mountains reminded me of tall hatted mushrooms. Some have veiled women among a laden caravan, but all have a corroded edging of trees. We drifted by a few other rafts and their lanterns. At times I saw rhinoceros horns or a blackened cathedral. At times the beauty of a carnivore's jawbone. One place was as dramatic as a vertical windsock. There was a broken palace in a fog-bound wilderness. The next day we travelled to the village of Xinping. We found their drabness and squalor, a terrible indifference and listlessness. Worst of all, the poverty in people's faces, the smallness of those lives. Everything was the colour of dust and of smoke. How can they not be embedded and millions with them? They see the comfort of cities each night on the communal television, just hours off and behind a stone door. Earth could not bear the weight were they all of them to have a fraction of what they know. We who delighted there for a few days could love nature because of its indifference and found our freedom in that. To do so one must be secure. The same type of mountains were at Xin Ping, but I saw in them the sadness of eternal things. This poem was translated and put around the walls of a gallery in Beijing, and an old Chinaman came up to me and after reading it and said, Mr. Gray, now we have your heart. But of course he didn't mention that the heart was a heavy one after seeing the situation of China. This poem is also influenced a little by the Chinese. They often in old encyclopedias of Chinese knowledge, they make lists which seem to have absolutely, to our eyes, nothing in common with the things in the list. Seem to be very remotely connected. I thought of making a remotely connected list. It's called Classifying the Animals. It's written in anaphora, you know, where you start each line, or practically each line with the same word, and each line is self-contained. Classifying the animals. There are those that in the distance seem a swarm of gnats. Those that with their barking try to rally us in a campaign against the stars. Those that torment their prey. Those that follow both sides of an argument. Those that have broken a precious vase. Those that can only be painted with a one-haired brush. Those whose tongues like candles on the fingers of our hands. Those that curl their tails. Those that refute the argument from design, such as bed bugs and liver flu. Stupid ones who lie still for a while and then run. Those whose being makes an those whose being is quenched as though it were a knot in a frozen rope. I've been revising. Those that are bored, the good-natured beetles, those such as frogs and snails that are enlightened beings, humans born unable to stand, those that are fit to be emblazoned on a flag, mosquitoes, crocodiles, those that should exist, unicorns and mermaids, unacceptable ones, unless we can make a great rational effort, those that cause people to smile, ladybirds, etc., those that stir in us an erotic feeling, those that are easily broken and yet their kind continues to exist, those that one would like to be, the centaur, the phoenix. And just one more poem. This one is called Flames and Dangling Wire. It's about a great rubbish dump that I once visited outside a city. It mentions horse laughs. Horse laughs are an expression for mechanical laughter on sitcom programs, but forced laughter. Flames and Dangling Wire. On a highway over the marshland, off to one side the smoke of different fires in a row, like fingers spread and dragged to smudge. It is the always burning dump. Behind us the city, driven like stakes into the earth. A water bird lifts above this swamp as a turtle moves on the Galapagos shore. We turn off down a gravel road, approaching the dump. All the air wobbles in a cheap mirror. There is a fog over the hot sun. Now the distant buildings are stenciled in the smoke, and we come to a landscape of tin cans with cars like skulls that is rolling in its sand dune shape. Amongst these vast grey plastic sheets of heat, shadowy figures who seem engaged in identifying the dead. They are the attendants in overalls and goggles, hawking over rubbish on the dampened fires. A sour smoke was hauled out everywhere, thin like rope. And there are others moving, scavengers. As in hell the devils might poke about through our souls after scraps of appetite with which to stimulate themselves. So these figures seem to be wandering disconsolate with an eternity in which to find some peculiar sensation. To get out and move about also, the smell is huge, blasting the mouth dry, the tons of rotten newspaper and great cuds of cloth. And standing where I see the mirage of the city, I realize I am in the future. This is how it will be after men have gone. It will be made of things that worked. A labourer hoists an unidentifiable mulch on his fork, throws it in the flame, something flat like the rag held up in the raft of the Medusa. We approach another through the smoke, and for a moment he seems the demon with a long barge pole. It is a man, wiping his eyes. Someone who worked here would have to weep, and so we speak. The rims beneath his eyes are wet as an oyster and red. Knowing all that he does about us, how can he avoid a hatred of men? Going on, I notice an old radio that spills a standing wire, and I realise that somewhere the voices it received are still travelling, skidding away riddles around the arc of the universe, and with them the horse laughs and the Chopin, which was the sound of the curtains lifting one time to a coast of life. Thank you.